This has been an incredibly challenging day for us. I'd like to thank my other assistant chief Bagtana and Etienne for helping us navigate through these waters. We acted immediately, and rest assured that the process does work. When police officers see something here that they think is inappropriate, they act immediately.
You are hearing from who is now the acting police chief at the New Haven Police Department, but a man who was an assistant chief, and he was one of the key players in what transpired this week. The Connecticut State Police now investigating the allegations of misuse of public funds by now former New Haven Police Chief Carl Jacobson. Jacobson allegedly admitted to taking money from a city fund that was used for confidential informants for personal use. Now, we know, again, there are so many parts of this investigation that are still under wraps. This is still relatively brand new and still a shock to many. But we want to know what could be the criminal charges coming to Mr. Jacobson and potentially other officers at the department. Joining us now is attorney Bill Bloss, who, by the way, has absolutely nothing to do with any parts of this case. But he is somebody who is considered to be my legal expert on the show. And he is somebody who will weigh in on major cases that we are keeping a close eye on, like the one we're talking about today. Attorney Bloss, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Anytime, Melissa. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So, Bill, let's first start with, you know, what could possibly come from this? Again, we don't know how much money. We don't know how long this was going on. We don't know the motive. We don't know how we recoup the funds and all of that. But what could possibly, fall on Carl Jacobson since he's retired?
Well, there are state statutes prohibiting misuse of public funds, larceny, basically, statutes. The chief state's attorney's office has assigned the investigation to the New Britain state's attorney. And because the New Haven state's attorney works closely with the New Haven Police Department, the chief state's attorney decided to assign it out to New Britain, which is completely reasonable. Former Chief Jacobson is certainly looking at a potential state larceny charge. It could get a little more complicated if there are federal funds that are involved in this informant fund. The Department of Justice has given this New Haven Police $6.5 million in grants in recent years. And so the pedigree of that money, if it turns out to be federal money, then he could be looking at federal criminal charges for, again, misuse of public funds, which would be problematic, certainly.
And I'm curious if you think anybody else would be implicated or would essentially fall on the sword. It was interesting. I was reading the New Haven Independent, and in the story, it felt like there was obviously focus on the former chief, but there was even more focus on the new acting chief, David Zanelli. And the reason being is because his position as the assistant chief at the time, it says he had sole authority under the department's general orders to manage the CI money to serve as acting. And again, he's now acting chief. So I know that the article was kind of talking about, well, why was he named to this position? Again, that's under the charter and all of that. The New Haven mayor made that decision, and I'm not questioning that. But I am wondering, it may not be him, but did somebody else sort of have to facilitate this money being taken? And if that's the case, do they face criminal charges?
Well, I read the same article you read, Melissa, and the New Haven Independent has really done a fabulous job covering this.
Agreed.
Much more thorough than some of the other sources. But Zanelli contacted the Independent after that article and advised that he was in charge of he had access to the files of confidential informants, but that the funds were separate and that only Jacobson had control over the funds.
Got it.
So whether that's true or not, we're early in this, as you noted, and there's way more that we don't know than we do know. I think the thing that kind of gives me pause is that Jacobson had controlled these funds when he was the head of the narcotics unit, which makes sense. I mean, that's the, by and large, the place where you're going to use these funds. Mm-hmm. From before 2019. In 2019, then he kept control of the funds after he became chief in 2022. So the first question I would ask if I were investigating this is, how long has this been going on? And how do I find out how long it's been going on? How much is involved? I'm sure the state will be looking to see whether this has been going on for 6 years.
Well, and I think it kind of begs the question, too, is that a systematic problem? Because to your point, Attorney Bloss, when you see that somebody, again, we got that perspective actually from a former chief in a totally different department, which was that, you know, it's going to be somebody that's in either narcotics or somebody who's in investigations, essentially. Like, the chief is never going to be that person that is pulling money for CIs. Like, that's just not something that they're going to do. It's not part of their purview. They wouldn't even be the ones to make the request. Like, if somebody were to approach a chief and say, hey, I have information, the chief is going to be like, cool, that's not under my purview. Go to the investigators. Like, they're the ones who are handling it. So there'd be no reason for him to basically handle that money. But to your point, the fact that there was, you know, no transition of, okay, well, now that you're chief, who's going to handle this? That seems like a systems problem, which, again, maybe that doesn't fall on Zanelli, but it does potentially fall on somebody in the department or somebody overseeing, saying, why was this man still able to hold that position when he became chief? Because that's a problem.
Well, of course it's a problem. And that should have been perhaps a red flag at the time in 2022, you know, mm-hmm. chief, you don't have any contact with informants. You're not on the street anymore.
Right.
You're not supervising people on the street. You don't need to be in charge of this fund. So, you know, what are you talking about? And now, I suspect that there's some kind of institutional reluctance to stand up to the chief when the chief says, look, this is the way it's going to be. I mean, I've met Jacobson a time or two. He's a charismatic person. I'm sure that he would not be somebody that would be easy to say no to if he said that this is the way it's going to be. But, you know, Melissa, the disappointing thing, and if you live long enough, you kind of see things come around again. This happened before in New Haven.
Yeah,
it did. In 2008, a detective was arrested for exactly this, and then another detective was arrested for stealing funds from suspects. Now the first detective was acquitted, but it led to some serious institutional reforms, at least on paper. But I think what we are learning is that policies are only as good as the people who implement them, and there were apparently some shortcomings in the implementation here.
Yeah. And again, I thought, to your point earlier, Bill, I thought that the New Haven Independent did such a stellar job with this story. They're doing such a great job with reporting. It said that after this article, they actually, again, you know, kind of hinting at Zanelli, they said that he repeatedly asked Jacobson about control of the CI files and funds. In the article, it says that Jacobson reportedly responded to them that they needed training first, and that Jacobson promised to arrange for the training, but the training just never happened. And so, again, it's sort of to your point, which is that we've had, you know, history kind of repeat itself. Was this kind of a manipulation thing? And again, I know we're sort of going down a rabbit hole of, you know, what if, but it does sort of seem that way, which, again, I know Mayor Elicker said that this is kind of an isolated thing, that it's really just Jacobson and there's really nobody else involved in this. But it will be interesting to see, well, how over a 4-year period, 2022 to 26, how was he able to still be in charge of this? Like, how was that never addressed, fixed, or anything like that? That seems like a systems problem. And maybe it was an intimidation thing. But to me, how do you go almost 4 years of somebody being in the chief's role and still handling something that is really not under the purview of a chief?
Well, that's going to be a question that the state police and the state's attorney's office in New Britain is going to have to answer. I was interested in Zanelli's quote that he played at the beginning of this segment. You know, he said the process worked. Well, it kind of worked. It half worked. Mm-hmm. You know, well, Lieutenant Werner did blow the whistle, and to his credit, right? I mean, you know, that's not easy to do, to say to a, you know, Jacobson's probably going to get arrested. And that's not, you know, a super comfortable place for Lieutenant Werner to be in. I suspect, I don't know what their relationship is, but still you're ending a person's career and probably sending him to jail. But, you know, so to that extent, the process did work. Okay. Yes. But as you said, it didn't work apparently for a long time before that, maybe 4 years, maybe 7 years. We don't really know.
Right.
And so, you know, it's glass half full, glass half empty. Good people stand up and do the right thing, but lax policies and lax enforcement enable people to take advantage of the system, and that's bad.
But if I'm hearing you correctly, Bill, it sounds like the only one who really is in danger of, I would think, doing prison time would be Jacobson. It wouldn't be anybody at the department.
Well, so far as we know, I mean, who knows if other people were involved in it? If you know, what if Jacobson says, you know, look, I this is what I did, but you know, you should be aware that so and so and so and so also were doing this, and you know, so anything today, anything is possible. I think the one piece of advice I would offer, I think, is for everybody to be patient. Expect that there's going to be a thorough investigation. It could be by the feds. It could be. It's certainly going to be by the state, and they'll get to the bottom of it. And it's not going to be pretty. I mean, that I'll guarantee you. This should never happen.
We have our legal expert on the show. Attorney Bill Bloss is here again. No connection to any of the cases that we're talking about today. Really quick while I have you here, Bill, I know we'll dive more into this, obviously, as we see what unfolds. But two other cases we're keeping an eye on right now in the new year. One is Michelle Traconis, convicted for her role in the 2019 disappearance and death of Jennifer Farber Dulos. She was back in front of a judge this week, going to be back in front of a judge again later this week. And for a third time, this is a habeas corpus hearing. What are the chances, you think, at this point, Bill, that she gets a new trial and potentially could actually see her sentence end?
Well, hard to say without knowing all of the evidence, but I will say that habeas cases are very rarely successful. She is claiming that her lawyer at the time, and Andrew Bowman, was ineffective, constitutionally ineffective, in advising her to speak to the police when the interviews wound up really becoming part of the foundation of the case against her in the accessory to murder case. So it's that is a tactical decision, and tactical decisions are very, very hard to challenge and lead to a reversal of a conviction. So I would not be very optimistic, frankly, if I were her.
The other case that we're keeping an eye on is right here in Milford, Raul Valley, who delayed the case twice of a potential new trial because we weren't sure if he was going to have an attorney. Essentially, he had said that it was so expensive, the first trial, paying his attorney. He's got a new one. Darnell Crossland, who's a very familiar name, I think, in Fairfield County especially. What do you think in this regard? My understanding from Mr. Crossland is that he plans to file motions, and if the court approves them, it could mean avoiding a second trial.
Yeah, he says that he's going to file a motion to dismiss the case on the grounds of double jeopardy. Unless he has got some thought I just don't, has never crossed my mind, I think that's not going to go anywhere. Because his statements in the press were he was acquitted. Valley was acquitted on the more serious charges, which in his view should lead to an acquittal on the less serious charges. That's kind of not the way it works. It works the other way around. If double jeopardy prevents somebody from being tried twice for the same charge. But there's a concept of implied acquittal. If a jury verdict impliedly acquitted, expressly acquitted on some charges, but because of the way the elements of the crime are, there would be an implied acquittal on a different charge, then you can't be tried on the second charge. But that doesn't really apply where there is a different mental state required between the acquitted charges and the charges that were mistried. If you'll remember, the charges that were acquitted were intentional acts. The charges that were mistried involved reckless acts. It's a different mental status. Mm. And being acquitted on intent charges doesn't mean that you didn't act recklessly. So I'll be interested to read the motion, but it doesn't feel like it's going anywhere to me.
Well, and the other thing that's interesting, and by the way, Raul Valley, for those of you who are not familiar, the man found not guilty last year of murder in the deadly stabbing of Jimmy McGrath at a Shelton House party back in 2022, and potentially seeing a second trial maybe this year. What I found interesting about this as well, is, you know, as you mentioned, with, you know, going with these new motions and Jeopardy and all that. I think it's interesting. There was a reporter who had asked if there was going to be a plea deal on the table. And Mr. Crossland said that's not something he's focused on. I thought that was surprising because you and I have talked about the fact that the only way that this second trial wouldn't happen essentially is if there's a really good, you know, plea deal on the table. And he's not even really entertaining that at this point.
Well, that's what he's saying.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't. Okay. I mean, I
see, this is why we have you on the show, Bill. This is exactly why we have you on the show. Your reaction is exactly what I needed. Okay. So that yeah, is probably something behind closed doors that is obviously being, you got a way that I would think if really the goal is to avoid having a second trial and having closure to this case, I would think you have to at least entertain that idea.
Well, there is undoubtedly somewhere on the spectrum of potential punishments where a defendant would have to say, I am not going to roll the dice and try to win this trial twice. You know, if the reports are to be believed, the overwhelming majority of the jury was in favor of conviction on the manslaughter charges, on the second degree manslaughter charges on the first trial. And, you know, that is some predictor of what would happen at the second trial, not necessarily, but some predictor. So there is undoubtedly some place on the spectrum of punishments where he would say, I don't really think I want to roll the dice on this again. On the other hand, if the state is offering him a maximum sentence, why would he take that? Because that would be the worst that could happen after a trial. So, you know, I'm sure there will be some negotiations, or there will be an offer for sure. Whether he takes it or not depends on a couple of things. One is how strong he thinks his motion to dismiss might be. Second is whether he thinks that he's really got a reasonable chance at avoiding a conviction on reckless manslaughter at a second trial. So, you know, those discussions will happen and the family will be involved. The McGrath family has a right to be heard before a plea bargain offer is extended. And has a right to be heard before a judge accepts it and sentences a person. So, but that's just routine. It there will be an offer, whether he takes it or not, depends on what the offer is and depends on how he thinks he's going to do it the second trial.
Well, we certainly will have to see, starting with what the court decides to do with these motions filed by Darnell Crossland, again, the new attorney for Rahl Valley, who is set to appear back in court on March 25th. Attorney Bill Bloss, again, nothing to do with any of the cases that we talked about, but he is our legal expert on the show and gives us such incredible insight and perspective. We thank you so much, Bill, always for giving us the time. We appreciate it.